This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 23rd, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, in Egypt, voters turn out in large numbers for the country's first truly democratic presidential election. U.S. Congress debates a wide-ranging transportation bill that could include the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. And we'll go to an Iowa town where residents point to health concerns in the shadow of a thriving industry.
I breathe it every day. That poison kills more people than anything else. Down here sometimes, that it is actually, it's like you can reach out and just grab it with your hands. It's that hazy and that foggy.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Tens of thousands of people marched in the streets of Montreal yesterday to mark the 100th day of the student strike. More than 100 demonstrators were arrested overnight, and more protests are planned today. From Canada, FSRN's Stephanie Clermont reports.
Students and citizens filled the streets of Montreal yesterday to show support to the student strike and in defiance of Special Law 78. The new law states that protests of 50 people or more are forbidden unless organizers give detailed itineraries to police. Organizers accuse provincial leader Jean Charest of trying to kill freedom, and one protester who didn't give his name told FSRN that the government has lost all credibility.
The international community is talking about what's going on in England, in France, in Brazil. People from the University of Sao Paulo wrote us a letter. People from Chile wrote us too. It's unthinkable to maintain a hard line in this context.
Solidarity demos with the Quebec students were held in Toronto, Paris, and New York. Max Liboiron, who is with Occupy Wall Street, is an organizer of the New York Solidarity Demo.
We're facing the similar sort of pushback from the state, police brutality at the hands of the state, all of these sort of structural issues that are similar despite the content sometimes being different.
Another march is planned for tonight. Stéphanie Clermont, FSRN, Montréal.
70 of Spain's top university chancellors walked out of a meeting today with the Minister of Education, who refused to discuss budget cuts after yesterday's nationwide teacher and student strike. From Madrid, FSRN's Luis Perez reports.
All over Spain, teachers and students are standing up against the 3 billion euro budget cut to public education planned for this fiscal year. These cuts would drastically downsize the number of teachers, put more students in each classroom, and practically shut down thousands of libraries and special education programs. Students feared the budget cuts would reduce scholarships, increase tuition, and gradually privatize the public education system. The federal government's decree to ration education spending infuriated working-class Spaniards, especially after President Rajoy announced a 10 billion euro state rescue plan to prevent the financial collapse of the country's third-largest bank. Yesterday's strike was considered a success by the teachers' union, with more than 90% absentee rate in universities and 70% in basic education. Organizers say approximately 100,000 people protested. Police reported no more than 40,000. Other strikes and protests will continue in June and throughout the summer. Luis Perez, FSRN Madrid.
A Pakistani doctor who helped the CIA locate and gather intelligence about Osama bin Laden has been convicted of treason by a Pakistani court. The tribal court sentenced Shakil Afridi to 33 years in prison, despite efforts by the U.S. to secure his release. While working as an informant for the U.S., Afridi ran a vaccination campaign as a cover for trying to collect DNA samples from bin Laden's household. According to Doctors Without Borders, the deceptive use of medical care makes it difficult for legitimate public health workers to deliver services to communities in need. In other Pakistan news, a U.S. drone attack killed at least four suspected militants, according to international media. The United States is currently pressuring the country to reopen supply routes to Afghanistan. About 120 students and teachers at an Afghanistan girls' school have been poisoned. Afghan police announced today that they suspected conservative Taliban radicals. According to Reuters, schoolgirls were found unconscious in several classrooms after an unknown substance was released into the air. The students were hospitalized, but no deaths have been reported. Another attack on a girls' school happened last month when the school's drinking water was poisoned. Last week, FSRN reported the Pennsylvania Republican governor's proposed budget would deeply reduce public services, including education. That's forcing school districts to cope by cutting thousands of jobs. Today, across the state, union members protested, calling on the legislature to restore the funding. From Philadelphia, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo reports.
It's not just a union issue. It's about the deal that we're supposed to have.
That deal is about union members working hard and making a decent living wage. But deep cuts to education from Governor Tom Corbett are challenging that union tenet. In Philadelphia, the district plans to close 40 schools over the next year and lay off 2,700 union members, like protester Ronald Amore.
And we're not here to tear the system down. We're here to make sure that the system and the infrastructure, which is the working man, stays in place.
The SEIU 32BJ union, which represents school bus drivers, janitors, and other education support personnel, is fighting the proposed cuts.
32!
Union members took to the streets in 8 cities across the state. In Pittsburgh, some were even arrested. The state Senate has passed a budget that doesn't cut as deep as the governor would like, but despite this, activists continue to pressure elected officials for a living wage. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, Philadelphia.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Egyptians turned out to vote in large numbers today in the country's first true democratic presidential elections in history. Across the country, voters went to polling stations to choose from a list of 13 possible candidates representing a broad spectrum of political backgrounds. From Cairo, FSRN's Noel King reports.
For many Egyptians, voting in the presidential elections marks the culmination of an uprising that forced dictator Hosni Mubarak from power in February last year. Voters at polling stations throughout the capital, Cairo, expressed a mix of pride in the revolution's accomplishments and anxiety about the country's future.
Mixed feeling. I'm happy because at least we're selecting one out of 13. I'm not very happy with the choice.
It's not what we wanted exactly, but it's something like what we want. It looks like what we wanted.
The country's transition to democracy has been plagued by setbacks, and Egypt's president will take office without knowing the full extent of his powers, because the country has yet to approve a new constitution. While there are 13 candidates on the ballot, polling data suggests that Egyptians are divided among 4 frontrunners. Those leading candidates represent an emerging political trend in Egypt, in which Islamist politicians are pitted against secular candidates with ties to the Mubarak regime. Tariq Samer, who runs an event planning company, says he's voting for Egypt's secular former foreign minister, Amr Moussa.
I was proudly voting for Amr Moussa. Out of all, he has a lot of levels of experience locally, internationally, connected, has the experience of dealing with establishment, say the IMF, the World Bank, the United Nations, the EU. We cannot be in a phase of trainee for a president or a trial and error for a country.
Another candidate with links to the former regime, Ahmed Shafiq, surged in the polls in the final days of campaigning. Presenting himself as a law and order candidate who would get tough on crime, Shafiq openly mocked Egypt's youth activists, at one point sarcastically offering to give them candy if they would leave Tahrir Square. Shafiq served as Mubarak's final prime minister, spending only a month in office before he was swept from power during the 2011 uprising. He has attracted the support of Egyptian Christians, many of whom are worried about the rise of political Islam, and secularists who appreciate Shafiq's no-nonsense attitude. Ezat Ishaq, who owns an import business, says Shafiq is the man to turn around Egypt's economy.
I know Mr. Shafiq is the best for develop Egypt. No. I'm not. Shafiq is same Mubarak. No. This is not correct. Shafiq, I know this this person can develop, can start, can make everything new for Egypt.
Egypt's youth vote is also divided. Some young people say the revolution has failed to deliver meaningful change in Egypt. A council of high-ranking military officers took charge after Mubarak's ouster. The Supreme Council of the Armed Forces has been widely accused of a litany of abuses, including violent crackdowns on peaceful protests, targeting pro-democracy activists, and trying civilians before military courts. 21-year-old architecture student Alia Sabri is voting for Hamdin Sabahi, a secular Arab nationalist whose political platform focuses largely on improving the lives of poor and working-class Egyptians.
From everything I've heard, he's very genuine. He's extremely simple-minded. He's not driven by religion, and he wants to give everyone their rights.
Sabahi, long viewed as a dark horse candidate, appears to have made significant gains among youth voters, even in the final hours of campaigning. 18-year-old janitor Kamal Hamada says he respects Sabahi because the candidate supported the Egyptian uprising from the beginning.
Sabahi is not a member of Mubarak's regime. He was with us in Tahrir. What the military council wants is for us to vote for Shafiq or Musa. Those are their candidates. Sabahi is the revolution's candidate. He's a son of Tahrir Square.
Egypt's Islamist candidates are also expected to make a strong showing in the presidential race. The liberal Islamist Abdelmunem Abu Futuh has been polling strongly in recent days. Abu Futuh broke with the Brotherhood over his plans to run for president. The Brotherhood's chosen candidate, Mohamed Morsi, has been criticized for lacking charisma, but has the backing of the powerful organization behind him. 57-year-old Saher Gaber turned out to vote for Morsi. Gaber says he's voting pragmatically.
This group, although I'm not from it, but this group is very big, and they are in every part of the poor country. So I think it will be better. And it's not marriage. We can throw him away anytime we want. Tahrir is there, and after 4 years, he will not be here.
Voting will continue on Thursday. This week's vote is widely expected to be the first round of the presidential elections. If no one candidate captures more than 50% of the vote, a runoff between the top two candidates is scheduled for June 16th and 17th. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
The clock is ticking for the U.S. House and Senate to resolve their differences on the wide-ranging transportation reauthorization bill. Funding expires next month. The Congressional Conference Committee has been grappling for weeks over many controversial measures in the bill. The House version would slash funding for bicycle and pedestrian programs, prevent the EPA from regulating coal ash pollution, and approve the Keystone XL pipeline, even as new reports show the project wouldn't lower gas prices or create nearly as many jobs as its backers claim. From Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
With funding for the nation's highways, railroads, public transit systems, and bike programs on the line, the House and Senate passed drastically different transportation bills last month, and now must craft a single bill they're confident will pass both chambers before the end of June. The Senate's two-year bill maintains most funding at current levels, increases some federal transportation grants and loans, and gives states more control over projects. The House failed to pass a Republican-backed five-year bill that boosted highway funding at the expense of public transit, biking, and walking programs, so they passed a short-term funding extension, which mandates the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline, in order to start the conference process. Congress has been trying to pass a long-term transportation reauthorization since 2009, and Rhode Island Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse told reporters Wednesday that continued delays and uncertainty are hurting his and other districts.
Every day that the conference goes forward, every day that we don't have a bill to the president's desk, it becomes harder and harder for our state to fund the projects that they have scheduled for this summer's highway construction season.
One of the many points where lawmakers disagree is funding for so-called transportation enhancements, which include bike lanes, programs like Safe Routes to School, and sidewalk improvements. Some House Republicans are pushing for their entire elimination, but Committee Chair Barbara Boxer told FSRN she fought to protect funding for these programs in the Senate version of the bill and will continue to do so as the conference goes forward.
They're critical for the health of the people. They're critical as alternatives to, you know, getting in a car or a bus. They're critical for safety reasons, and they're critical for our children who would love to be able to bike safely, and we know that it's not some frivolous investment.
Last week, Washington, D.C. held its largest ever Bike to Work Day, with more than 12,000 registered participants. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood wrote on his blog that this high turnout shows that cycling is, quote, an important part of the 21st century transportation mix, and that funding for bike infrastructure and programs must be preserved. The Department of Transportation is also advising Congress to strike out the House provision to bypass the normal review process and automatically approve the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline, which would pump tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, to refineries on the Gulf Coast. House Republicans have hailed the project as a means of lowering gas prices, but a new study challenges that claim. The National Resources Defense Council published a report Tuesday saying the pipeline would actually raise gas prices, especially in the Midwest. Anthony Swift with the NRDC was the lead author of the report.
By shifting oil from the Midwest to the Gulf Coast, there will actually be less gasoline produced from that oil, and that's less gasoline available to the U.S. market.
TransCanada resubmitted its permit request to the State Department in April and has been aggressively lobbying local governments in the states along the pipeline's proposed route. But some residents continue to fight back. In Nebraska, landowners sued state officials on Wednesday, saying its new law favorable to TransCanada is unconstitutional. One of the plaintiffs, rancher Randy Thompson, says the statute illegally allows the governor to grant TransCanada eminent domain.
And the idea that a foreign corporation could actually come into our state and start condemning Nebraska properties when that same company doesn't even have a permit to operate within our country.
The State Department rejected TransCanada's first permit, in part due to concerns about the Nebraska route, which would threaten groundwater and environmentally sensitive areas. The company has since revised the route, but the Nebraska landowners say the new version still crosses the Sandhills and the Ogallala Aquifer, and they will continue to oppose the project. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Today we continue our examination of the country's prison system by focusing on the for-profit facilities that are playing an increasingly larger role in detaining and deporting immigrants. In the U.S., about half of all immigrant detainees are housed in private for-profit facilities, making immigration enforcement a multi-billion dollar industry. Advocates have long condemned conditions inside detention facilities, and in 2009, the Obama administration pledged to make improvements. But a new report from the ACLU of Georgia finds that serious abuses are still ongoing. For the details, we're joined by Azadeh Shah Shahani, National Security and Immigrants Rights Project Director at the Georgia ACLU. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much for having me, Dorian.
This report looks at four immigrant detention facilities in Georgia. Three of them are privately run. Give us a quick overview of the findings at these facilities.
Right. So as you mentioned, our report raises serious concerns with the way detainees are being treated, and we believe that the conditions violate the detainees' human rights, fundamental dignity, and constitutional rights. So we evaluated the findings and realized that detainees are being denied access to adequate medical care as well as mental health care. Detainees have their due process rights violated as a result of detention at these facilities. And we also found abuse of power by those in charge, including the guards, and other violations as well in these facilities.
And I want to get into some of those specifics of this report. But first, one of the primary issues that comes up is that often detainees are transferred far away from family or the support network. At one of the facilities that you look at, the Stewart Detention Facility in Georgia, one-third of those in this report had been transferred from out of state. So before we get to the specifics, how does this, at the very beginning of the detention process, how does this affect the process?
Right. It affects the detainees and their families tremendously. You know, at all the facilities, we found that detainees had been transferred from out of the state, you know, from all over the Southeast. And even in Georgia, you know, if you look at the distance of these families from urban areas, the two facilities, the Stewart Detention Center and the Irving County Detention Center, are located more than 3 hours from Atlanta, which makes it very difficult for families and communities of support and attorneys to get down there and to be able to lend support to the detainees in the detention centers.
And looking at these detention centers themselves, you talk about the conditions at the facilities. What are some of the problems with living conditions that you found?
Right. We found overcrowding. For example, the hygiene situation was very problematic. So, for example, at the Irving County Detention Center, which is a corporate-run detention center in Ocala, Georgia, detainees are not provided new underwear, which at least in one case had led to a serious infection for a female detainee. And we also found that detainees feel that their privacy is not respected because of the conditions of the living quarters. Detainees at the Stewart Detention Center, which is another corporate-operated facility in Georgia, also had complaints about quality of the water.
The budget for these detention facilities has been increasing during the past several years. In the 2012 fiscal year, the House of Representatives approved a budget of $2.75 billion for detention and removal. We've spoken about some of these detention facilities that are privately run. What's the significance of the fact that these facilities are privately run, that they're run by corporations?
So I think, you know, when you look at the broader picture, you know, obviously the corporations, their motive is profit-making, is to generate profit for their investors. And obviously there is deep tension between the profit-making motivations of these corporations and what the American values of justice and liberty demand, which is, not unnecessarily detaining people who do not have to be in detention in the first place.
The report is called Prisoners of Profit, Immigrants and Detention in Georgia. Azadeh Shashahani is the National Security Immigrants Rights Project Director at ACLU Georgia. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
To hear the first part of our series on sexual assault and a culture of impunity at a women's prison in Alabama, go to our website, fsrn.org. On one of the sharpest bends of the Mississippi River, the southeastern Iowa town of Muscatine is known for its flourishing local economy and picturesque sunsets. But it's also one of the most polluted cities in Iowa. Since 2007, Grain Processing Corporation has violated federal and state pollution laws more than 100 times. Recent violations are prompting the EPA to investigate the company for air and water pollution. And some who live near the corn wet milling facility have developed respiratory illnesses. FSRN's Joe Cadot has the story.
Downtown Muscatine runs along pristine Mississippi riverfront, scattered with remnants of the pearl button industry and the lumberyards from which the town was carved in the mid-1800s. The Chamber of Commerce stands at the foot of Muscatine's historic district, where touristy shops and small-town attractions are frequented on cool, blue-sky spring days. Chamber President Bill Phelan has lived in Muscatine most of his life.
We have a plethora of businesses here that are waiting to serve you and serve you well. We pride ourselves on being a business or a community of business. We are blessed, and truly blessed is the term, to have a corporate base here of wonderful large corporations. GPC is certainly one of them. But we are also blessed with a great community of small businesses, organizations that care about their community, and a great educational system, and people that really care about each other.
Muscatine has among the highest number of corporations per capita in Iowa. With a population under 23,000, Muscatine provides more than 7,000 local jobs in manufacturing alone. Among the top employers are Monsanto, Heinz, and Grain Processing Corporation, which is considered one of the nation's largest processors of corn syrup, spirits, and corn starch. Despite the widespread presence of industry throughout Muscatine, Phelan says downtown is clear of smog 95% of the time. But that's not the case for what locals call the environmental ghetto. Just miles south of scenic downtown, thick yellowish-black smog rolls through the streets nearly every day. Cars, streets, and houses are coated in yellowish-black soot. Outside Grain Processing Corporation, plumes of what appear to be corn fiber fall like snow. Many who live near the plant say the smog stings their eyes and gives them headaches. Water from kitchen faucets is known to run brown and occasionally black. Sherry Leonard moved to the south end of Muscatine 31 years ago to find a job at one of the city's many factories. She says she got chronic bronchitis from exposure to asbestos while working at a sports lighting manufacturer. Recently, the Department of Natural Resources issued an air quality warning for Muscatine County, advising people with respiratory illness to stay indoors. Leonard says the air in her neighborhood is hard to breathe almost every day.
I always know when my eyes are burning, my nose is burning, we come back to town from being out of town. My sister lives down there. As soon as I get down there, my eyes are like watering and burning and my nose is all sore inside.
Leonard is a member of Clean Air Muscatine, or CLAM, a local environmental group trying to stop the grain company from polluting the air and water. Leonard and CLAM Executive Director Jessica Brackett pay a visit to lifelong Muscatine resident Sharon Mockmore.
Hello.
Hi.
My name's Jessica, and I'm from Clean Air Muscatine. Do you have a moment?
Yeah, just a minute.
Inside Mockmore's house, her husband lies on a hospital bed where he's confined after having part of his lungs removed last year from cancer.
We're knocking doors to tell people about the air quality here in Muscatine.
You don't have to tell me nothing. I breathe it every day. That poison kills more people than anything else. Down here sometimes, that it is actually, it's like you can reach out and just grab it with your hands. It's that hazy and that foggy.
While Mockmore fills out paperwork on the couch, her grandson Gary Horton enters the living room, eager to join the environmental activists. Horton says his brother, mom, and grandparents all have breathing problems.
All kinds of nasty, terrible things that were continuously, I've been breathing it in for 19 years now. I mean, it's sickening to me to think that there's such a lack in quality control in our county that you can barely see the school some days. It's a half a block away. It's ridiculous.
The EPA could charge Grain Processing Corporation up to $37,000 in fines per day if the company fails to address the three recent violations of the Clean Air Act. An 11-year EPA violations report found the company exceeded limits on 14 chemicals emitted or spilled, including sulfur dioxide, lead, and ammonia. A company spokesperson says they are investing $100 million for a system that will reduce sulfur dioxide emissions by 87% and small particulate matter emissions by 63% over the next 3 years. Until then, community members say they'll keep fighting for clean air. Joe Cadot, FSRN, Muscatine.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carisley. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.